We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the current crisis that's going on in Ivory Coast in Africa. This past fall, people in that African nation cast their votes in the country's first presidential election in 10 years. Now, the international community has recognized a man named Alassane Ouattara as the winner, but the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, has refused to step down, and there is some fear that the conflict between the two men and their supporters might lead to civil war. Well, this morning in this hour, we'll be talking about current events in Ivory Coast with two guests, and both of them have spent quite a bit of time in Ivory Coast over the last couple of decades. Tom Bassett is professor of geography here at University of Illinois. His research focuses on development and environment in Ivory Coast, where he has been doing field research ever since 1981, and he's written a lot about Ivory Coast. Carol Spindell is instructor of English, and her experience goes back to that same point in the early 80s when she went with Tom when he was there to do his field work, and she also wrote a book that was published a number of years ago, a very nice book about her experiences there, getting to know the place. The title of her book, In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove, which I believe is still in print. Is that right? No, it's not in print? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I thought
available.
That it was. All right.
Easily available.
You can seek it out in the library. And she has now done some more recent writing about Ivory Coast because, in fact, she was in Ivory Coast for the election this past fall. She did some pieces that we aired here on WILL. They also were reprinted in the newspaper. And she and Jason Croft put together a program, One Village Votes, which aired just before Christmas. And if you did not hear that and you'd like to go back and listen to it, it is available on our website. You can go to will.illinois.edu. And we're pleased that both of them could be here to talk with us this morning. And as we talk, questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you both very much for being here.
No, it's a pleasure.
Let me just do a little microphone adjustment there.
Okay.
Make that a little bit better.
We're glad to be here.
I think this is actually at least the second time that we've had this conversation. And when you talk about something like this, one of the things that you have to do is go back and go back perhaps some time, because understanding where you are right now, you have to understand where you've come from. And that means going at least back to the point that the country became independent. It had been a French colony. So we can do that. But as a way of starting out, though, is there something about what's going on now, the conflict between these two men and their supporters and where their base of support is, that tells you something important about Ivory Coast? Or is that too big a place to start?
Well, you do have to go back to understand what's happening, and I think it would be hard if our listeners don't know any background to keep up with what's happening. We could go back to 2002 when there was a failed coup and armed rebellion, and the country was split into north and south. And we could say, why did that happen? Why did the country split between north and south? And then we could go back to the 90s when Houphouet-Boigny, the very first president of the country who took the presidential armchair in 1960 at independence and stayed until his death in 1994, suddenly he dies. There's a big power vacuum, and multi-party democracy and a free press comes in, but there is only one political party, and so political leaders are vying for supporters, and that is when fissures really begin to be created by these political leaders between Northerners and Southerners.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's one other thing that is in play here, and it may be something that you see other places in Africa too, and that is people are arguing about identity and what it means to be Ivorian and who is and who isn't. And then how that connects with who gets the access to the reins of power. And that seems to be a very important theme here involving conflict, the sectional conflict, and also the conflict between the two individuals and their supporters.
Right. And we can talk about what seems to be unique to Cote d'Ivoire, but we have to remember that this is a country that was created in 1960. So whatever we talk about here today, we're talking about a country that just celebrated its 50th anniversary. And there seems to be some periods or benchmarks in which unprecedented things happen. Well, the first president stayed in power from 1960 to 1994. It was a period of relative stability. It was benevolent dictator rule, a prosperous period. After that, multi-party democracy has not worked very well. And there have been, especially around the 2000 elections, unprecedented violence, massacres. This is like unbelievable to have taken place. And we sort of crossed the threshold at that point. And today, where there has been a certified election by the United Nations in which a clear candidate has won and the incumbent refuses to step down, this, again, is unprecedented for Cote d'Ivoire. It's never happened. And it's the repercussions, of course, are regional because it is such a major player economically in the region. So it seems to be going from one unprecedented event to another. So it's hard to characterize it as something unique to Cote d'Ivoire. We're kind of like, what's next?
Yeah. Well, and maybe one further thing, one thing that's really important here, and the reason that other governments in the region are looking at this is that whether this is resolved, how this is resolved, could be very important and could set a precedent one way or another for transitions of power other places in the region. So it's a lot of the stories I read, test case, that phrase keeps coming up.
That's really true. I mean, we're really on the brink, I think, of maybe a new era in Africa where the UN had never been invited in to certify an African election before. I mean, we don't invite the UN in to certify our elections, you know. Most people don't. It's an incredibly meticulous process. And so for one of the first times in Africa, you know, or in any place where an election is disputed, we know without a question of doubt who won. This election was meticulously observed. The results were tabulated independently by the United Nations using like a three-pronged system. So there is no doubt the international community doesn't have to hesitate to stand up behind Alassane Ouattara because they know that the Ivorian people elected him.
So there's this investment that the United Nations has made in this election, and to see that investment be wasted is something that they're reluctant to do, number one. Number two, there, of course, one of the solutions to this conflict, we have two individuals proclaiming themselves president and appointed their own cabinets. It's not unprecedented. In Zimbabwe right now, we have the winner of the last election there, now prime minister, and Mugabe still in power. In Kenya, we have a power-sharing arrangement as well, where Odinga is prime minister to Mubaki's presidency. Both of these cases are viewed internationally as failures. And the UN doesn't want to replicate that. ECOWAS, the West African Economic Community that's involved in this negotiation process, does not want to see that happen. Everyone would like to see the incumbent to step down.
Carol, you were there for the election, and as I mentioned, you did some pieces and we had on our air, and then we have this long piece that you put together that people can go back and listen to. The election, this was an election that had been put off and put off and put off. It was supposed to happen in 2005, and because there was a lot of unrest, it was put off, so it finally happened. When you were there and you had an opportunity to talk to people, you asked them, I'm sure, well, what are you thinking about? Are you excited about voting? Are you optimistic about what's going to happen here? How do you feel about things in the near term? What sort of things did people tell you?
Oh, people, it was really moving to be there, David. I mean, especially knowing the country as I do and knowing the North, where I spent most of my time. I was there for the first round, which was held on October 31st. There were 14 candidates running. That was one of the criteria for a good election that could be certified. It had to be inclusive. Everybody who wanted to run ran. So there were 14 candidates. And people, first of all, they are desperate. They have been through 10 years of instability. Instability leads to terrible economic hardship. You know, it's really eye-opening to go to a place where there's no functioning government. Nothing really works, and nobody has a job. Unemployment among young people is almost half, almost, you know, in the 40%. And so, although in the North, where I spend a lot of time, people are farmers. People are subsistence farmers. But even there, they're just blocked in so many ways by having a divided country. They're cut off from the economic capital, can't send their children on for higher education, can't get their crops to market. They need for teachers and health workers to come from the South, which is more developed. So they're really just over and over, they just said, we're just so tired of this. We're just worn out with this. We want to have this election, and we want stability and peace again, and we want a reunified country. And that was just unanimous. Every single person I spoke to said the same thing. Mm.
Let me just introduce very quickly the two guests for this part of Focus. Carol Spindell, she's an instructor of English here at the University of Illinois, and her husband is here, Tom Bassidy. He's a professor of geography, and we're talking about Ivory Coast. Tom has been doing work there ever since the early 80s, and the two of them have been back there a number of times. And as Carol just told the story, she was there for the election this past fall. It came in two rounds in October and in November and led to this disputed result with two individuals, the man who the international community says won, claiming the presidency, and the incumbent also claiming the presidency. And there's now an effort, particularly of the West African nations, to try to get some resolution to this. And we'll talk some more about it. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. The first president, Mr. Ufwe Boigny, who was president from independence in 1960 up until the time that he dies in the early 90s, what sort of person was he? And during that roughly 30-year period, the first three decades of independence, what was life like for people on Ivory Coast?
Well, in the 1980s, the prices of coffee and cocoa, Ivory Coast is the number one cocoa producer in the world and also produces Arabusta coffee, which is what mostly goes into like instant coffee, whereas when you go out and buy beans, you usually get Arabica, different species, variety. But anyway, they produce a lot of coffee and cocoa. In the 1980s, the prices of these things on the world market were very high. So Ivory Coast, especially the South, prospered during that era. And there was a lot of national unity. People thought of themselves as Ivorian. A lot of poorer people from neighboring countries came to work in Ivory Coast, and they were welcomed, immigrants from Burkina Faso and Mali in particular. Mm.
This was a one-party state. All right. So in terms of politics, there was just one party. Everyone belonged to the same party. And it was when we were there in the early 1980s, there was clearly a sense of repression in terms of freedom of speech and the ability to sort of criticize your leaders. Because if you were critical, your ability to advance socially, economically, was quite limited. So there was clearly, they were amazed as we were talking about, I think Ronald Reagan was president at the time, and we had some things to say about our president that were not particularly favorable. And the people around us were amazed that we felt so free to talk in those terms. So there was political stability at the expense of democracy and civil liberties.
And there was a state-controlled media. So there was one newspaper, one radio television broadcast system, and always the same things would be on both every day. And you would, you know, have to wait for the next day to hear something different.
But Ufwe Boigny was revered as sort of leading the nation to independence. He was a freedom fighter, I think legitimately one could say, in the 1940s when he was elected to the French National Assembly as a representative of West Africa and militated against forced labor and succeeded in ending forced labor in West Africa at that time. And so he came with a set of accomplishments that and he's a skilled politician. I mean, he did have in his cabinet representatives of different regions, different ethnic groups. It was a kind of classic patron-client relationship. Mm. Support me, you will be taken care of. Go against me, and you'll spend time in jail. And that's what happened to anyone who really raised opposition to this form of autocratic rule. But as I said earlier, it was a kind of benevolent dictatorship.
And one of the people who spent time in jail was Laurent Gbagbo, the man who will not now leave the presidential palace. So that's very ironic. He was an opposition leader for democracy at the time.
And Alassane Ouattara is somebody who also has been involved in Ivorian politics and government for a long time, too. So these men, they're not newcomers. They've been around for
No, some fresh blood would be a really good thing for the country, but that's going to take a little while.
Well, that in a sense, this is jumping around a little bit, but that but one wonders in sort of practical terms, what difference it makes as far as life for people in the Ivory Coast. Which of these two men is president?
Well, that's been a question that we've always asked ourselves too, because when these candidates run for office, their platforms are not particularly clear. Right. What are they going to do for the country? What are their social programs? What are their economic programs? How do they distinguish themselves? Now, Carol, when she was there in October, she had the opportunity to see these candidates on TV and these very kind of open, fresh kind of interviews. So maybe you have more to say about that.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to give tremendous credit to the UN because the mood around this election in 2010 was really different from anything I have observed there in the past. And I think, you know, I think a lot has been learned. And I think the idea that, oh, multi-party democracy is great for everybody. Let's bring it into this country that's never had it and it will flourish. Well, I think people have learned it doesn't work that way, especially you have a very large proportion of the population that's not literate, didn't take civics in school and doesn't have that understanding of what their rights are as a citizen, what they could demand from political leaders if they vote for them. So I think a lot of education was done by the UN and by various non-governmental organizations that resulted in this election. And it was really remarkable to see that. There were just constantly little public service announcements on television. You know, here's how to vote. Here's what a candidate can and cannot do. Here's what you can and cannot do to support a candidate. They would be acted out. They would be in languages other than French so that non-literate people who haven't been to school could understand them. And every night there was a program, and each of the 14 candidates went on the air and had to answer questions from journalists for an hour and a half. So every single candidate had their night on Face aux Électeurs, Face the Voters. And it was wonderful. The questions were tough, and they said, look, I don't see where you're going to find the money. You say you're going to do this, this, and this, but where's the money going to come from? They asked tough questions, the journalists, and the entire country sat down and listened. Mm-hmm. It was just great to see. And then in the second round, I think this may be the first time this ever happened in Africa, there was a live television debate between Gbagbo and Ouattara. Again, an hour and a half, and again, the entire country pretty much. I mean, you know, even in villages, there are a few people with television sets, and people can gather in those places, and people were listening.
We should try that. Sounds like a good idea.
Well, another thing that would be a great idea, I think, personally, would be the code of good conduct that all the candidates had to sign in the presence of the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, of the United Nations. No personal attacks, no attacks based on gender, ethnicity, religion, a whole list of things they agreed not to do.
And did they pretty much hold to that as far as you could see?
In the first round, it went really well. It was exemplary. The special representative of the United Nations, the day after the election, he was beaming. You know, there wasn't a single violent incident in the whole country. And he was said to the Ivorian people, congratulations, you have surprised the world. You know, you've had this election in a place where people thought you couldn't do this, and look what you did. It was great. In the second round, with Gbagbo and Ouattara, the rhetoric became much more inflammatory. The tension mounted, the ethnic references, the accusations. Gbagbo would accuse Ouattara of being a puppet of the French and of the foreign community, international community. And Ouattara would throw accusations right back about these repressions in the streets in 2000 and so on. So it got quite a bit uglier in the second round. But when they came on TV that night and had this collegial debate, everyone breathed a sigh of relief. I mean, and that really did help calm the waters.
Yeah. Especially when they agreed to accept the results of the election, of course, which hasn't happened.
The very last thing on that debate, live, Ouattara turned to Gbagbo and said, well, let me ask you, Laurent, my brother, one last time. Do you pledge yet again to accept the results of the election? And Gbagbo said yes, he did. Hmm. And they shook hands.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation in Belgium. That is the town in Vermilion County, not the country. On our line four right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask a naive question here, and it might not be completely germane to the topic, but it might get to the basis of things. It's amazing, as we go around the world, so often any country seems to be, when there's internal strife in countries, it's always between North and South. I know there's East and West Germany, but that was imposed from the outside. Even East and West Timor was imposed from the outside by the British. Why is it something in human nature that just always makes people divide themselves North and South? Could that be part of the problem?
Well, Tom's the geographer. I'm going to pass him that question.
No, I don't think it's a human part of human nature. I think in this case it's part of the political economy and history of this particular country, where this country, particularly the Ivory Coast, is the bottom. The southern half is within a tropical rainforest, and the northern half is within a savanna region. Coffee and cocoa, palm oil, pineapples, rubber, main cash crops, the source of wealth, located in the south. Food crops, some cotton, cashews grown in the north. So there are major differences in incomes between northerners and southerners. And, of course, in terms of the development of the country, the south is better developed in terms of the north. So there is an interest in northerners and being part of the country and benefiting from government budgets and a more equitable distribution of resources. But in this particular case, the candidate Ouattara comes from the north, and his disqualification from the 1995 elections, from the 2000 presidential elections, because of his suspected nationality, essentially disenfranchised his political base, which is essentially the north. So that's the political dimension. There's historical, economic, and political dimensions of this particular divide.
I understand that, sir. I understand what you're saying there, but I'm just saying it seems awful coincidental all over the world. It's always north and south, United States, north and south, Sudan, Korea. It just keeps going on and on all over the world. It's interesting that it always seems between north and south. That was the point I was getting at.
Yeah. Well, but I think the point the caller makes, and I think that you responded to it, Tom, was that environmental issues, ecological issues, natural resource issues are intimately connected with politics, and cause people to divide along lines. You know, however you manage to draw that line on the map.
And there are also cultural issues. I mean, Ivory Coast has a number of different ethnic groups. They speak different languages. But in general, there's a kind of cohesiveness in the north of language and cultures that relates to countries north of them, Mali and Burkina. The Mande people and Sanufo people are found up in this area. So there is also the cultural issue that there are a number of different regions culturally and linguistically.
We're just about our midpoint here. Let me very quickly introduce again our guests, Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. Tom's professor of geography at the University of Illinois. He's particularly interested in the geography of developing countries, and he has done research on development and environment in Ivory Coast in West Africa. He's been doing field research there back ever since 1981 and has written a lot about that. Carol, her experience goes back to that point as well when she was there living with him and he was doing his research. She wrote a very nice book, In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove, that you can find maybe in the library, and maybe you can find yourself a used copy.
It's very easy to find. If you go on the used book market on the internet, there's lots of copies.
It's a good book. It's a really nice book. I would recommend it. We talked about it. I think that's probably the first time we ever met.
That's right.
When the book was brand new. So I would suggest people can take a look at it. And if you're interested in some of the writing that she has done more recently about her experiences going back last fall when she was in Ivory Coast for the first round of the election, you go to our website and you can listen to a program that she was involved in putting together, One Village Votes. So you can go to will.illinois.edu and you can listen to that. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, one of the things that I want to get back to is the identity issue and how that came into politics. And I guess it's my understanding that this really became a big issue after the death of Félix Houphouët-Boigny and the guy who came after him. And it seems that that in part it was, and it certainly connects to where we are now, it was invoked, this issue of Ivorian identity was really invoked to sideline Alassane Ouattara, who was running or wanted to run way back there. And we're talking about the early 90s at that point.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about the birth of what's locally known as Ivoirité, the sort of the essence of being Ivorian. And this was something that the successor of Houphouët-Boigny, his name is Bédier, Henri Conan Bédier, who was the president of the National Assembly at the time of Houphouët-Boigny's death. And the Constitution says that it's the president of the National Assembly that becomes president. Although Alassane Ouattara, one of the key players in this current conflict, was prime minister at the time. So he had lots of visibility and was a contender for the presidency following Houphouët's death. So Bédier was the interim president and preparing for the elections for 1995, began this kind of ideological kind of crusade in which being Ivorian was important. And as in many ways, it was tied also to land issues, I must say, because this coincides with an economic crisis in Côte d'Ivoire where many urban unemployed youth returned to the countryside and found that they couldn't actually take up farming because the land was already occupied by, in many cases, foreigners. Immigrants from Burkina Faso and Mali who had been there since the 1940s and who had been, over time, had acquired land and were growing coffee and cocoa. So this is the beginning of a time when new land laws were being developed. Created because there's no real private property in Côte d'Ivoire outside of urban areas. So as a development initiative, this is the kind of World Bank initiated also, there was this attempt to create private property. And so the first article of the land law states that only Ivorians can own land in Côte d'Ivoire. So just to show that this notion of who's Ivorian and why that matters was gaining ground at this point. Part of it had to do with economic crisis and land claims, but also Bédier wanted to marginalize Ouattara from running for office. And so he basically passed a law which stated that only candidates can run for office whose both parents have been born in Côte d'Ivoire. And it was claimed that Alassane Ouattara's father was born in Burkina Faso. So this notion of Ivorité, of Ivorianness, and who's Ivorian, and the kind of rights that entails, whether it's to land or political office, took off. And this was part of, I would say, a divide-and-rule strategy, frankly. The previous call talked about North-South. This is a convenient trope of politicians trying to divide the electorate in their favor. Ethnicity, or who's Ivorian, was another one.
Mm-hmm. Well, aside from this issue of who could run for the president, were there other ways in which people who were not, according to this definition of who's Ivorian, who would have been considered to be less Ivorian than others, say people who had not been born in the country, or maybe whose parents had not been born in the country, did they face discrimination in other ways?
Well, it went further than that, because then it began to be that Northerners who were legitimately Ivorian, even if they were born in Ivory Coast, began to be equated with foreigners by Southerners, by these Southern politicians. So they became, like Ouattara, less Ivorian than Southern Ivorians. And that was the whole sort of essence of Ivoirité. And that really created a huge fissure and created a lot of this instability.
And that really it contributed to people in the North taking up arms and getting to the point where the North-South conflict starts to be an armed conflict.
Well, you know who has roots in the North because of last names. People have very few last names in each ethnic group. So you can look at someone's last name and know their ethnic group. So even though many Northerners live in the South has the majority of the population, of all ethnic groups and of all religions, you can tell that they're originally from these Northern ethnic groups by their last names. And these people began to have trouble in elections, legislative elections, mayoral elections, getting voter cards and identity cards. So there was genuine political exclusion, and Northerners did feel tensions. They were attacked in the South during some of these violent clashes, and neighborhoods that were known to be inhabited by Northerners were burned down. I mean, so they did suffer some very real exclusions and marginalizations politically and discrimination.
We have some other callers here. Let's go to Effingham, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Program, like most others, always seem to address the issues that have been grinding humanity to dust, is about the rule of a few and the rule of law. And my questions, I suppose, are who are the few and what is the law and who makes it and who conforms and who does not? I mean, the tragedy of human existence now for the last 10,000 years have been, I can't put a name to the horrors that go on, have gone, and will go on, and for what reason, even in civilized countries such as proposed civilized countries like the U.S., which are the warmonger of the world, and upset indigenous peoples for the last 600 years. And what is that all about? Are we going to be nice and play nice? Are even little bodies like Effingham here have 5 council members, and they are a power unto themselves? What the people want, what anybody wants, is in the mud, and they go ahead and do whatever they want based on the name. Well, what I'm about to do for you is good for you. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well,
I think that is true, that Ivory Coast is certainly a classic example of how a few people have benefited while most people have not benefited from the riches of the country. The country does have cocoa, coffee, and some oil. Some diamonds and some gold, so as well as a very active agricultural economy. So, again, a very few people have benefited from that, and I think the caller, that's true. It's one of those cases. The question of rule of law is a really interesting one in this particular election, and it's kind of complicated. I'll try to make it really simple and talk about what's interesting about it, but Ivorians did not want a civil war. I mean, they had seen what had happened in other countries, and they went to the brink of it, and there were a few violent clashes. But really, they did a remarkable thing, and they stepped back. and there were a number of peace accords. There was one conducted in Paris, a suburb of Paris, the next one in Pretoria, South Africa, and the last one in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, in 2003, 2005, and 2007, these three accords. Laurent Gbagbo, the man who doesn't want to step down, asked the United Nations, he was head of government temporarily, to come in and bring in a peacekeeping force and peacekeeping mission. And there is a special representative in Ivory Coast from the Secretary General of the United Nations. There have been a couple different people who fulfilled that post. The man right now is named Choi. He's a South Korean diplomat. And they've all done a remarkable job. I mean, I have to say, having been there in person, I am really impressed at what the UN has done, the links they have gone to support the Ivorian government, support democracy, and forestall, you know, extremism, the violent elements, the hardline elements, create a sort of national discourse of dialogue and reconciliation. It was really remarkable to see that, and I really think that they tried so hard and together helping the – I mean, you know, the caller said, of course, the people are disadvantaged vis-a-vis these few people who have all the money and power. But then you bring in something like the United Nations, and they kind of have the people's back, and they even up the sides a little bit, and the people – we came so close. They came so close. They voted democratically. They voted their choices. They were not intimidated. In the village where Tom has done research and where I've lived since 19 for 30 years now, 744 people voted. 17 votes went to the incumbent president, Laurent Gbagbo. So people voted their choice. They felt free to do that. Most of these people were not literate. They touched their finger to an ink pad and touched the symbol on the ballot that they wanted. Most of them voted for Ouattara. There were a few votes for other people among the 14 when I was there. But that really was remarkable. And that's why I think the world has to keep supporting them.
Well, not to take anything away from that, but one wonders here, you were in the north. This was Mr. Ouattara's region. He was a northerner. They were northerners. And going back to, I think, what Tom said a little bit earlier about the fact that doesn't seem to be a place where people are always real clear whether talking about, this is what I am going to do. So were people just voting for Mr. Ouattara because they said, well, we're northerners. He's a northerner. This is the North. He is our guy. And not necessarily because they thought he would be a better leader or because they knew what he would do, but because he was the favorite son.
Well, there are a couple of things. He is the favorite son of the region, and they did identify with him when he was excluded. If he wasn't Ivorian enough to run, then I'm not Ivorian enough to take part in politics. So unfortunately, it was his exclusion by his rival politicians that really cemented that regional identification and made it so strong. I think among educated people, there's also the reality that Gbagbo has been in power for 10 years, and they've been 10 terrible years. Now, I don't think Ivorians have quite the same election sort of mentality that Americans. We're big on change. Like, okay, we gave you your chance, out. Let's try someone else. I think they have the opposite. Okay, we'll give you a little more time. They're more patient. But 10 years, it had been the worst 10 years in the country's history, and people wanted change. They said he's had 10 years. Nothing has been accomplished. When his hour and a half came and he was on TV and the journalist said, "Why, you said you'd do this. You said you'd do that. You haven't done any of these things. Only your cronies have enriched themselves. You know, what's up here?" And the only thing he could say in his defense over and over, he said, "Well, I wasn't expecting a civil war. I wasn't expecting a civil war." In his defense again and again, he continued to repeat. And that was true, of course. It's hard to accomplish much when the country is divided in civil war. But the South had not benefited either, where he had continued to govern. So I think those were two very big things.
I may want to just add here that, of course, these last 5 years of these past 10 years, he's been in office only because of international agreements. There should have been elections in 2005, but they have been perpetually postponed. Procrastination, roadblocks. So Gbagbo has persisted, and he's very pugnacious. And so, in fact, it's because of these international accords in which the UN has a legitimate role to play in verifying elections, that he has been he stayed in power.
Just as maybe a small point, is there in fact question about Mr. Ouattara's parents and where they were born? As if that should really, I suppose, if that should matter at all, really. But is that still open to question?
It's interesting, David. You know, Ouattara's father, I believe, was born in what's today called Burkina Faso. Mm-hmm. In the 1930s, when, in fact, Burkina Faso didn't exist. Even Upper Volta, the predecessor name of the previous name of the country, didn't exist. In fact, it was incorporated into Ivory Coast. This is part of the French West Africa.
So we're really not sure.
And
there were very few papers, in that area. So we really cannot say, but it definitely seems to be a political ploy that is not going to benefit the country one way or the other.
I just return to the previous caller's questions, which I think are really go to the heart of democracy and citizenship and participation, and the sense of whether we're American citizens feeling not very well appreciated or views considered. And places like, I think, Cote d'Ivoire, throughout the world, you need at least three conditions for a thriving democracy. One is rule of law. You cannot get away with committing crimes. And impunity is something which has been the rule of the day in Cote d'Ivoire. There have been human rights abuses, and they're ongoing, and no one's been punished. So the rule of law is key for a functioning democracy. What you also need is an independent judiciary. When people are breaking the law, they are brought to court and punished. We do not have that in Cote d'Ivoire. In fact, the Constitutional Court, the highest court in the Ivory Coast, which legitimated the elections in favor of the incumbent, the president of that court is a crony of Gbagbo, right? And he overstepped his boundaries. He didn't have the right to annul the votes in the north. But anyway, we do not have an independent judiciary. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, we need civil liberties. We need an independent press. And one of the first things that Gbagbo did on the eve of the election was to introduce a curfew.
For election day itself.
And then 3 days, 4 days, about 5 days later, stopped all foreign TV emissions into Cote d'Ivoire. And only the national TV was airing. And this is a government-controlled media. And so all you have are Gbagbo's messages to the population, which is pure propaganda, and which the United Nations has called an instigator of hate, hatred in Cote d'Ivoire as well.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me just again introduce the guests. Tom Bassett, he's professor of geography here at the University of Illinois. Carol Spindell is instructor of English. They both spent time in Ivory Coast in West Africa, going back to the early 80s when Tom was there to do field research. And Carol was there for the election in October. And if you'd like to, again, hear a piece that was put together based on her experiences, you can go to our website and listen to One Village Votes. Right here on the show, you can call with questions 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, now we have this unusual situation where we had the elections, the two rounds. In the second round, essentially, it was the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, and the challenger, Alassane Ouattara. The international community reviewed the elections. They said these elections were on the up and up, and Mr. Ouattara is the winner. And he said, yes, I am the president of Ivory Coast. Mr. Gbagbo, and with the assistance of the Constitutional Court, which is under his control, they annulled the votes from the north, and he said, no, I'm the president. So now here in Abidjan, in the presidential palace, we have Mr. Gbagbo. He says, I'm the president. And in a hotel across town, we have Mr. Ouattara, and he says, he's the president. And so now we have this standoff, and a number of nations of the West African nations are trying to want to go in there and try to see if they can get some kind of settlement. Ideally, what they would like is for Mr. Gbagbo to step down, which he so far seems reluctant to do. He said, no, I'm not going to do this. What do you think is the possibility here for things being settled?
It's very difficult to predict, David. This is, again, one of these unprecedented developments. the West African community, ECOWAS, has threatened military intervention if this current round of diplomacy fails. And basically, there's a group of presidents from West Africa meeting with Gbagbo as we speak. And they say they're there to facilitate his departure. Mm. Now, Gbagbo, on his New Year's Eve speech, the population of Cote d'Ivoire said, "I'm not leaving." So we know that this is going to go nowhere. So, but where is it going? Where would Gbagbo like it to go? I guess is of course, he wants to stay in power, and he's going to do all that he can to do that. And right now, my view is that this international community is unified and speaks with one voice. You lost the election. Time to go. And the longer he can drag this out, for example, he's employed a couple of French lawyers, and they're calling for, let's recount the vote. Of course, it's drag it out and longer and longer. And ultimately, people get tired of it. The fissures will emerge within this international community. And so you have that's his strategy. Then you have Ouattara and Soro saying, like, if this does not succeed today, we need military intervention. Now the question is, is the ECOWAS, is the West African military force up to the task? Mm-hmm. Are they capable of doing that? Gbagbo has threatened to retaliate. About a quarter of the 20 million people that live in Cote d'Ivoire are foreigners. He said, can you imagine what's going to happen to these people if a foreign army invades? I mean, he's threatening. He's threatening the citizens and inhabitants of the country to stay in power. I mean, this is really pathetic, sad, and dangerous.
I'm thinking, though, if I'm one of the leaders of one of the surrounding countries, I'm going to want to think long and hard before I sign off on a military intervention to replace even someone who is seen to be illegitimate, replace the leader of another country. That's me. That's about the last thing that I would really want to do.
Well, of course, many of these West African presidents have shaky political basis and legitimacy to be in office themselves. Yeah. So,
which makes it sort of remarkable that they're standing up to Gbagbo and mm-hmm. makes me feel a little hopeful for a new day in West Africa. But Ghana, which had a good election and has a democratically elected president, he has just said that he will not send troops. I don't know. They don't have many troops. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's worried about mm-hmm. these reprisals against Ghanaians who live in Ivory Coast, mm-hmm. but he won't do it.
So the rest of the world says that they support Mr. Ouattara, and I think also though the rest of the world is taking this posture that says to the people in the region, look, you've got to get this worked out. So the question is, well, what sort of pressure could the United Nations or the government of France or anybody else put on Mr. Gbagbo to persuade him to leave? I mean, is there a constructive way for an outside power, say it's outside of Africa, to be involved here?
Well, I guess the only leverage we would have, the United International Community, would be financial, to quit buying Ivorian cocoa. They're trying to cut off his access to government accounts, and they're working behind the scenes. But people seem to think that that will take some months, and that if his money source dries up, he might leave. Mm-hmm.
So now Ouattara, in fact, is authorized by the Bank of West Africa to sign off on checks, accounts for Cote d'Ivoire. So the strategy here would be to, if there are all these civil servants, a large number of them in Cote d'Ivoire being paid by the government, including the military, if their paychecks are not coming, maybe they'll come over to Ouattara's side. Mm-hmm. That said, to meet the month of December's salary bill, what Gbagbo did was to go to these government agencies that control oil and refining oil and the port and cocoa, and took their money to pay the civil servants. So, there is this possibility that he will find ways to keep on paying the civil servants while Ouattara controls officially that authority.
So I don't know. All we can say is stay tuned. But in the meanwhile, the people are suffering. They're not going to school. They're not going to work. Food prices are rising. Death squads come into some pro-Ouattara neighborhoods at night. And, You know, it's a very, very difficult situation for ordinary people.
France's hands are tied in this because the discourse of Gbagbo, if you read the press in Côte d'Ivoire, if you listen to the media, the TV station, Gbagbo's presenting this international community's outcry as a conspiracy led by France, the former colonial power. And how can the former colonial power, take over this country again? We cannot allow it to happen, right? So it's that kind of Mugabe ideology of it's all the foreign powers, the former colonial powers that are at the root of the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. now has been taken
us in with it too.
President Obama has repeatedly called on Obama to step down. The current ambassador to Ivory Coast for the United States has been very active in calling for Gbagbo's retreat. So it doesn't seem like France is going to be, although France is there under the UN's mandate. It's there to support the UN peacekeepers. So if they are in a corner and need assistance, France will act. But act independently is politically impossible right now for France to do anything.
And within the military, is there strong support for one or the other of the two men?
Well,
and is that how much difference can that make?
We don't know, but some people say that there are only three generals who are loyal to Gbagbo, and that the overall in numbers of soldiers more are probably loyal to Ouattara and understand what's happening and are pragmatic about the future. But of course, we don't really know. That's very hard to say.
It seems that the military is supporting Gbagbo. I mean, there were tests a couple of weeks ago when there were demonstrations, when Ouattara's militants hit the streets to protest. I think they were hoping to see the military crack, but it didn't happen.
So do you think
they fired live ammunition on the protesters?
So do you think now, within the next couple of days, that we'll actually know something?
I don't know.
Or it could just continue to drag on for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard to say. We just have to stay tuned.
Well, I guess there we'll leave it, unless you have a last thought that you'd like to leave with folks.
Well, we're just keeping a little bit hopeful.
Côte d'Ivoire was at the verge of a new era, a democratic government, a unified country. And a lot of effort has been invested in that, in achieving that. And it's just so sad to see this happening. I think that that Gbagbo will leave. I think he will leave.
Well, we'll leave it there. We'll keep watching. Our guest, Tom Bassett, he's a professor of geography here at the University of Illinois. He's been writing about development and environment in Ivory Coast for a long time, going back to the early 80s. Carol Spindell, instructor of English, both here at the University of Illinois. And if you'd like to listen to the piece that she put together based on her experiences there with the election in the past fall, Ivory Coast, One Village Votes, you can listen to that anytime you like. It's on our website, will.illinois.edu. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us, David.
Thanks for having us.